just repeat what was in the email, that so far we haven't scheduled any afternoon sessions, but we would like to have some afternoon sessions, particularly along the lines of, you know, someone said, well, there's a topic that came up in lecture, or even virtual, and I really don't know much about it, and I'd like to have this explained. Like a further discussion. So we're really organizers today, and Robert are looking for suggestions along those lines. And we don't have to do it so publicly. You can send an email for the day or just come up with any of us and make suggestions for afternoon sessions.
And if you didn't get that email message, let me know what your email address is so that I can put you on that list.
Okay, so this morning I want to start by saying some kind of a few general remarks about what kind of structure we expect in string theory. So Graham yesterday gave this very nice picture of thinking of quantum field theories, basically probing the quantum field theory by putting it on all possible manifolds. And somehow then by cutting the manifolds you can see what are the states in the theory. And actually, something like that, I feel, is what we are doing in string theory, in the sense that we are looking at all possible kind of compactifications, and somehow by probing all these different compactifications, we are also kind of probing what are the states in the theory. And so in some sense, I think it's a giant leap that we're trying to do in space-time what we used to do, say, in terms of two-dimensional conformal field theories and Riemann surfaces. So in particular, if you have, say, in string theory, we would have, say, some compactification on a manifold X. So suppose we have a d-dimensional manifold, which is compact. And then, say, we throw in some remaining non-compact directions. The question is, what kind of data are associated to such a compactification? So we want to think of X as being part of our space-like manifold. So you would like to say that there is at least a Hilbert space, H of X, associated to these data. But the important thing is in string theory that whenever you do such a compactification, in general, there will be not one particular set of, well, you don't simply get the states, you actually get a family of Hilbert spaces over a moduli space, which often called the moduli space of Vecchia. So we have a MX is a moduli space. So we not just get a simple Hilbert space, we get actually kind of a bundle of Hilbert spaces. And I should say bundle within quotation marks. Because it's very well possible that there might be jumps in the fibers, so it's not necessarily really a smooth infinite dimensional vector bundle. So this is somehow the basic structure that we want to associate to a manifold X. So we have this space, and over it the space of this bundle of vector spaces. And in general, the moduli space will be written as a quotient of what would be the Teich-Muller space, so mod G, where G would be the duality group. This is a typical situation where the Teich-Muller space is kind of simply connected. Now, a further piece of data is that states in the Hilbert space will carry charges under the resulting gauge fields in this uncompactified space. So there will be a charge lattice, say gamma of X. Well, lattice, it will be just, say, for the moment, we'll just assume it's just some Z vector space. It's not necessarily has an inner product on it. And a very interesting point that's only kind of about now to be investigated is what is the issue of torsion. So there might also be kind of torsion information in the charges of the states in the theory. Now, having this lattice means that we want to decompose a typical fiber, H of X, in a sum of all charged sectors. So they're labeled by elements in this lattice gamma. of Ajax of B. So we have some decomposition of the Hilbert space in different charge sectors. And the important thing is that this decomposition behaves well under this fiber bundle, so that we have this this space will be typically a contractible space modded out by this discrete group G. So in particular, we will have that this gamma will be a representation of the group G. We want to impose this condition. That means that we also have a necessarily flat, say, gamma bundle over the moduli space. So these elements V and gamma we call the charge of the corresponding state. Now, in general, it's very difficult to say anything really sensible about how these states in these Hilbert spaces behave and vary when we vary the moduli. And anything that actually is known is on a particular subset of states, which are the so-called BPS states. So BPS states are so-called small representations of the supersymmetry algebra. I won't say anything about the supersymmetry algebra here, but the important thing is there's an action, say, of the super Poincaré group on this Hilbert space. We have a decomposition in representations, and there's a particular set of, say, degenerate representations, and we call BPS states. So the important thing is that inside this big Hilbert space, there's a subspace, which is the space of BPS states. And also these BPS states carry the same gradation by the letters gamma as do the ordinary states. The important thing is that typically the dimensions, so we have dimensions, let's call them D of V, which is the dimension of the graded piece of this BPS states of charge V, will be finite. So that although the space of BPS states is infinite dimensional, it's graded by gamma, and the graded pieces are finite dimensional. And so we have an interesting set of integers to be computed. And the second thing that we can often compute in situations here, using the supersymmetry algebra, is the mass spectrum of these states. So we have a mass, say M of V, which is a positive number. And this will be a non-trivial, so these of course are integers. Well, let me, so we have these integers which are the dimensions and the masses, which are the basically the spectrum of the Hamiltonian. And so M of V will be of course some function of the moduli. And actually D of V too, but since it's an integer, it's kind of locally constant. But the important thing is that D of V might jump. But often what we do is we will compute, say, the superdimension of these graded pieces. These will have a natural kind of Z2 gradation in bosonic and fermionic. So this will be just the dimension of, say, the positive part minus the dimension of the negative part, which is like the Euler number, and this will be typically be stable. So this will be a good, a well-defined number associated to the charge vector V and will not depend on the value of the moduli.
Is there an elliptic operator around?
Yes, quite often. In the situations where we understand what's happening, that's the case.
I got lost as to what relation gamma to G was. Let's say it's gamma's representation.
Well, the thing is that, so we have this moduli space, and we think of it as being the quotient by this group G.
Right.
And so we have here this this Hilbert space. So evidently would get some bundle structure on this Hilbert space. Let's assume it will not jump. But it also is graded by this group, by this lattice, this Z vector space gamma.
And what is
the Hilbert space is graded. So this is graded. So now if you go around, we want to naturally get some Newton action on the lattice gamma too. Yes. And it depends very much on the particular class of compactifications and the number of supersymmetries, what the structure is that you have on this lattice. Sometimes it carries a quadratic form, sometimes it carries a symplectic form, and that depends very much on the details, but this is typically a situation that you get.
What is that?
Sorry?
What is that space?
So roughly you would think of M as being the moduli space of data that you can put on the manifold X. So it's, well, actually it's I think it's the next thing I want to say. Yes. So M of X is the geometric data on X necessary to specify the string states. In that sense, I think it's very similar to the example that Graham gave yesterday, where, for instance, in a one plus one dimensional theory, you have a Hilbert space associated with a circle, and the circle could have, say, a length. And you get actually the quantization might depend on this length parameter. So just our picture is roughly that here we have time, and here is it's our manifold X, say, times some non-compact piece. Here we quantize the data, but somehow the Hilbert space that we are getting depends on the particular kind of the metric and other data that we pick on the manifold X. So we just not get, say, one Hilbert space, but we get a family of Hilbert spaces, then we vary the data that we have to pick on X. Now, in general, this will be kind of stringy data. They will depend, so it will contain things like metrics, but also things which are more or less tractable, like the string coupling constant. So there will be, and often this moduli space, or at least the Teich-Müller space, let's just do it for the Teich-Müller space, it will decompose to something like the Teich-Müller space of the conformal field theory on X, times things which go beyond conformal field theory. So there will be two, will typically be here schematically even or odd cohomology classes, which are the so-called Ramon-Ramon fields. So these have, in some sense, still a good geometric interpretation. And then there is another factor, which is the string coupling constant. So the string coupling constant is one of the parameters that define string theory. So that's one of the parameters that we have to pick somehow in order to do this quantization. And these are the things that they label the two-dimensional, say, quantum field theory. Yes. So in general, G would be the U duality. Well, this is say I'm writing the decomposition of the Teich-Müller space. So in general, the group G will not mix these things. That's why we only have such a decomposition if you go to the covering space. Yes. So, where this is this thing that we talked about yesterday, the string coupling constant that controls the genus expansion. And then you can make, so this is an expansion which somehow is the only thing which is kind of clear in the limit where G string becomes small, where we kind of use perturbation theory in Riemann surfaces. And then we can take even a second limit, we can take the limit alpha prime to zero, where the data that specifies our two-dimensional conformal field theory actually become completely geometric. So then we have a further decomposition of the moduli of the conformal field theory in terms of the well, really, the really the, say, the metric data on X times what turns out to be H2 of X times, again, an extra factor. So this is, say, alpha prime, or it was directly related to the volume of X. And this would be the space of Ricci-Flatt matrix with fixed volume. So here we get the really the geometric limit, where we can think of a classical space X together with an extra piece of information, which is this two-form, and the parameter which controls this expansion is the parameter alpha prime, which was the volume of the inverse volume of the manifold X. Yeah, so they No, so the idea is that this is a space which will be a mixture, indeed, of all of these ingredients. But somehow you pick out, you have to pick out, say, one parameter and say, well, this is the natural parameter, which is G-string. So that if you take that parameter to be very small, we can decompose this space in terms as I did here on the right-hand side. So we somehow identify the data of the conformal field theory. This. Also, yeah, so we have some modular space tau x, and somehow if we go, say, this is some corner of that. So here there will be like a natural parameter g string, and then say roughly here will be the parameters of the conformal field theory. So locally you can think of, well, the moduli space of the full string theory is just the moduli space of the conformal field theory, where we add these two extra data, these Ramon-Ramon fields and this string coupling constant. But that's only something which is should be valid, say, close to this, say, the border of the moduli space. If you write here in the interior, there's no obvious way to determine what the string coupling constant would be, in general. It might be even very ambiguous that if you, for instance, continue this parameter here, it might play a very different role if you hit another side of the moduli space.
Is it true that
Yeah, you mean it's appearing. Yeah, right. So this is the Ramon-Ramon field. This is the so-called NSB field. And for instance, indeed, the fact that H2 appears both here and here is, at least in the case when this we take the even cohomology, is a very important ingredient, because it's related to the so-called S-duality of the type 2 B string, where there are two B fields which can be interchanged. So there's even somehow a symmetry that interchange these two. But clearly, I mean, this way of decomposing the moduli space, in the same way, say, there is a way in which we have this duality group, will also be kind of decomposed in terms of something which is the duality group of the, which somehow respects this decomposition. So this will be the full duality, which is usually called the U-duality, which is, say, the automorphisms of string theory. Then it will be a subgroup which respects the first decomposition, which is often called T-duality, which are just, say, the automorphisms of the conformal field theory, the two-dimensional conformal field theory. So this is something which acts for fixed G-string, so it's a symmetry which acts for a given Riemann surface. And this is something which is only, which is the group that only kind of respects the structure when you take the large volume or this quantum mechanics limit. So this is somehow the geometric duality, which is typically would be just the component group of the diffeomorphism of the manifold X. There will be a natural action of the diffeomorphisms on these data. So in that sense, we have this three-layer structure that I started yesterday, and the same picture holds for the moduli space. So let me just now what I want to do is basically give one example of this structure. Well, I will start. Actually, at some point, I will concentrate on the example I mentioned yesterday, which is the four torus, just to explain this structure at least in one case as good as I can. But I will actually say a few more general things about strings on tori to start with, just to kind of set up the notation. So we will again work our way up through these three levels of complexity and start again by the quantum mechanics point. So kind of the example I want to treat now is the case of a torus T, say D-dimensional torus, which you write as RD over quotient by a lattice L. So L will be a lattice, say Z to the D, and we pick some basis EI for this lattice. And we have a metric, so a flat metric, G, and we will write its components GI, GIJ. So if we just do quantum mechanics, so let's go very slowly. Let's first think about quantum mechanics on this space. Well, then we have a Hilbert space, which are just the L2 functions on T. And there's a Hamiltonian, which is minus the Laplacian. And there's an obvious basis of eigenstates for this Laplacian, which are just the usual wave functions. So we can pick a basis of wave functions, say psi k, which are just the usual exponentials, where k is an element of the dual lattice. These are the, and of course these have eigenvalues k squared for the Hamiltonian. So h on psi k is k squared. Just as a little aside, this is somehow should be an explanation of how why these kind of cohomology classes typically will appear in all these moduli spaces. That whenever you have just say quantum mechanics on the torus, there's a simple way to modify it by picking a flat connection A on the torus. So I want to think of A as being a one form on T with a circle coefficient, so R mod Z coefficients. If you have a flat connection, then you can modify. So here we have our torus. Here's our point particle. And now we can say take a point particle around. So this would be a loop labeled by an element W in the lattice. And now we can modify our, of course these wave functions are just the ordinary functions or RD, which are made to be periodic. If you have a flat connection, you can slightly change the periodicity rule by saying that the wave function of momentum k, that the wave functions, if you go around the torus, they change with the wave function, which is 2 pi I to A W psi x. And if you, where A is just this kind of this linear function, and if you now solve for size of the usual exponential form, what you find is that the momentum k is now no longer an element of the dual lattice, but it's shifted with a shift which is just A itself. So it's a very simple fact that if you put a flat connection, that the eigenvalues of the Laplacian are shifted by A, and of course A is periodic, as is obvious from that formula. So if we now do the conformal field theory, well, we can actually do it in two steps. The first step is to do the conformal field theory not on the torus, but just do it on the vector space. So let's first think of X being just a vector space, so just R to the D, before we quotient by our lattice. And then it's a standard fact of two-dimensional field theory, just we're treating basically D free fields, bosonic free fields, that the Hilbert space associated to that. I mean, a nice way to write it is that it's the L2 functions on V, which is just the quantum mechanics answer, tensored with two Fock spaces, which I call F plus and F minus. And F plus is a Fock space, and a nice way to write it is as follows. So F, I write the notation F of Q, where Q is a formal variable. To keep track of a gradation. So the Fock space is the following thing. It's the free algebra, the symmetric algebra, on the sum of copies, an infinite number of copies of our vector space V. Let's say the vector space V appears in degree 1, 2, 3, 4, etc., where this is, which is the variable Q is keeping track of here. So another way to write it is that this is the product, tensor product of objects which I write as SQ N of V, but this is just, here I use the definition that SQ of V is just the usual infinite sum SN of V, where SN of V is just a symmetric product, so V to the N, not SN. So here you think of it as being, you take an infinite copies of V and gradation 1, 2, 3, etc., and then take the, just the Fock space on it, just the free algebra on it. And here you think of it as being a tensor product of Fock spaces just of a single copy of the vector bundle V, but they are in gradation 1, 2, 3, etc. And so this is an infinite dimensional vector space, but it carries a gradation by just keeping track of the power of Q. So if you wish, this has an expansion. But these are, of course, finite dimensional graded pieces. So this is the usual Fock space. And important thing to mention is that this thing is the gradation of the Hilbert space. So we have this operators L0 and L0 bar. And they are just giving in terms, say, of the wave functions, that the exponentials that are the wave functions on the L2 functions, plus what I write as N plus and N minus, which are just the kind of the operators that keep track, or it's just the gradation of the p's in the Fock space. So this n plus and n minus are the n's that appear in the gradation of f plus and f minus. So this is for the case of a vector space, and if you now go to a torus, something very interesting happens. So for a torus, so now let X be again T, which we write as say V modulo this lattice L. Now the Hilbert space turns out to be L2 functions on the torus times its dual, tensored again with these Fock spaces. So the reason that you not simply get, say, wave functions on the torus, but also on the dual torus, has to do with the fact that, say, if this is a piece of our string with world sheet space and time-like dimension sigma and tau, that you can have configurations where x, say, of sigma, if you go around, is not periodic, but is periodic modulo the shift in the lattice. So we're just using the fact that pi naught of the loop space of the torus is naturally given by the lattice L. So wave functions typically carry two, natural quantum numbers. One is the momentum, k, another one is the winding number, w. So w is the winding number. And if you work through the formulas, this is you will find that in this case, the left and right moving Hamiltonian L0 and L0 bar are now given by separate, so we have a separate P plus and P minus, P plus being in my notation the combination of K plus W and P minus the difference of K and W. So here you see appearing a lattice, a famous lattice, which is the Narayan lattice. This is the lattice, say, consisting of vectors P, which are a combination of a K and a W, where K is an element of the dual lattice and W is the element of the lattice. And so how you think about this is that this is a string which winds around the non-contractible loop W and somehow has a wave function which goes like e to the I kx, say, when it's as a function of the original torus. So string states are typically labeled by this combination of K and W. And we can so think of P sitting in a lattice, which you can write gamma, which is just this L star plus L, which is in a very natural sense an even and self-dual lattice. It's self-dual, obviously, if you look at this combination here, L star plus L. And it's even because the natural inner product, P squared, we define to be 2 times K dot W. So it's is an element in 2z. With this inner product, with this quadratic form, this lattice gamma becomes of signature d comma d. So that's the standard fact in conformal field theory, that associated to a torus, the torus naturally has two lattices associated to it, L and L star, and conformal field theory on the torus, we'll see here, part of the description of the conformal field theory is like a quantum mechanics of a point particle moving on the torus times its dual torus. And so there is kind of a natural lattice associated to it, which is this combination L plus L star. And that plays a fundamental role in the conformal field theory or string perturbative string theory moving on these tori. So there's a natural symmetry group here, which we can think of as the automorphism group of a string moving on the torus, which is the symmetry of this lattice gamma. So this is the group which would be ODDZ. And this is the T-duality group. So we saw that when we had the quantum mechanics case, the only obvious symmetry group would be the group SL dz. It's obviously acting on these wave functions. But here we have a bigger group, because this group here will act on this momentum lattice composed of pairs kw, and will map them to each other. Well, it's one thing to see that this group is naturally acting on this lattice. Another thing to see that it actually is a symmetry of the theory. And actually, as it stands now, it's not, because we have to kind of decide also how the group acts on the moduli of the system. And right now, the only thing that we picked is a flat metric on the torus. And in that setting, actually, this T-duality group is not yet a symmetry, because it can't act just on this class of compactification. So we have extra data. So the extra data is the so-called B field, which is, in this setting, simply an element of H2 of the torus with R mod G coefficients. And the way it enters is that we have maps, say, of a Riemann surface into T. That's the original point of our conformal field theory. And whenever you have such a map, you can weigh it by a phase, which is the integral over sigma of the pullback by x of B. So we can modify the sigma for the sigma model by adding this B field, which is very similar to adding this flat connection for the point particle. So it's the analog of the flat connection for the point particle. In fact, there's a very nice picture here. Suppose that this is our torus, and suppose we look at the string which is wrapped around the cycle W. We can now ask what happens to this, the wave function associated to such a string, if we go around, say, another cycle labeled by W prime. And we want to have, so we have some wave function, say, let's call it K, we get some exponential wave functions. Oh, sorry. So we have the wave function of an element of string which is wrapped around W. I want to see how it behaves if we go around the loop. And the formula is that this will now give you the B field, which is a two form. We can now evaluate on W, on the pair W, W prime. And that's actually the way the wave function is changed its periodicity. So as a wave function of x, now you see that, say, if you write psi w of x to be some I kx, then we see that k doesn't lie in the dual lattice, but it's shifted, and we see it's shifted precisely by the amount b, say, w. That's why it's titled like this, b and w. So we see now that the shift in the momentum lattice is proportional to B and by the winding number W. So this is a very simple analog of the flat connection for a point particle.
Presumably, you could pull B back to loop psi x and get a flat.
Precisely, yes. That's somehow the one-line interpretation of that. Yes, that on the loop space, it's a flat connection on the loop space. So we see that the general moduli space of the conformal field theory is not just picking a metric, but also picking this B field. And now there's a very nice result which says the following. Let me give an abstract definition of what the moduli space of conformal field theories is. Say on this torus T. We start with the vector space Rd, D, which I just want to think about as this lattice centered with the reals. And just now, what I make a decomposition of this. Orthogonal decomposition in a vector space V plus and V minus, where the inner product, the quadratic form, is positive on this piece and negative on these pieces. So it's a maximal positive and maximal negative subspace. Now, suppose we have an element P in our lattice, and we have such a decomposition. So I should say here that V plus is an element of the Grassmannian of d-dimensional planes in this vector space of signature D, D. Whenever you pick such an element in the Grassmannian, your vector P will decompose in a positive and a negative piece. So now we can kind of define the abstract conformal field theory by just saying that our L0 and L0 bar are given by this formula over there, with P plus and P minus given as they stand. So this is the most general way to decompose this vector in terms of a positive and a negative piece. But unfortunately, you can quite easily prove that this general element, the general way to decompose this space, is precisely characterized by the metric and the B field. And the way to do this is that if we have, say, this vector space is V plus, V minus, let's pick a basis of them. So we can pick a basis, say, of the form EI plus minus, which is, say, we take the usual basis vectors. So important thing to realize is that this gamma is L plus L star. And here we pick, say, basis vectors EI, so the I downstairs, and here we pick basis vectors with the I upstairs. Then V plus V minus have a basis of the form MIJ, but this matrix M is actually arbitrary. But now we can simply map it to the geometric data by saying that if we have a metric and a B field, which is symmetric and an anti-symmetric D by D matrix, then just the sum of them will be a general D by D matrix M that gives us this decomposition. So this is, say, the abstract setup, and here we see the geometric interpretation in terms of a G and a B. So the important thing to realize now, okay, so if you wish, these M's are just explicit coordinates on this Grassmannian, and if you have a matrix, say A, B, C, D, an element of this group, this T-duality group O, D, D, Z, then on this matrix M will just transform as A, M plus B, C, M plus D inverse. So it will act by fractional linear transformations. An important thing to see is that the symmetry of the string theory mixes the metric and the B field, which is the typical phenomena that we see if you go to conformal field theory, and we, in the large volume limit, we can think of the conformal field theory as given by this metric together with this two form, but then the symmetries will actually mix them, so somehow it's only in kind of the large volume limit that it makes sense to think about it in terms of a particular flat torus with a particular kind of this flat connection on it. In general, it will be some kind of a mixed object. In particular, also, these symmetries, if they act on a torus which does not have a B field, just this thing is completely absent, so M is a symmetric matrix, then acting by this general element of ODD will typically produce an M that's no longer symmetric, so it will have this B field there. So they really mix, so G and B mix. And the kind of geometric picture, as I said, only appears in the limit of large volume. So we have this Grassmannian, which actually is OD, can be written as a homogeneous space, OD times OD. But in the limit, so this is kind of the Teich-Müller space, in the limit where the alpha prime goes to zero, or the volume goes to infinity, this will decompose. This is just standard proof theory. Where these factors have the following interpretation. This is clearly the space of metrics, or if you use symmetric matrices, of the fixed determinant or fixed volume. So these are the fixed volume metrics. This is just H2 of the torus. So this is the B field. And this is alpha prime, or the inverse volume. So we see that these data only, and here of course this decomposition, the only symmetry group that respects this is this geometric symmetry group, SLDZ. So this is a very concrete example of such a decomposition of such a modelized space.
Times
Z
to the D choose 2.
Sorry?
Z to the D choose 2. The discrete shifts of the B field.
Yes. Oh, right. Yes. You mean here I can have R mod Z.
Right, so either you should call it R mod Z to the D choose 2, which isn't technically.
Yes. Well, let me just do it like this. I mean, it just...
But the discrete symmetry includes...
Oh, okay, yes. There's also a Z to D, yes. Yes. Which is, has a geometric... Yes. Did that do the wrong way? Yes. So this is very natural symmetry group that appears here. And so now we want to kind of move up one step higher and go to the full string theory. And, well, this is quite a long story, and so I would just want to now kind of make just basically some motivating remarks, just say from the point of view of the symmetry group. So we saw that through this d-dimensional torus, say from the point of view of conformal field theory, there's a natural, this t-duality symmetry group, ODDZ. And why did it appear? Well, there was this natural kind of, if you wish, there was the natural vector representation of that group, which was this group acted on this lattice L plus L star, which were winding and momentum modes. So one way to think about it is that if you had just point particles, the only kind of quantum number that a point particle carries is its momentum. But if you have strings, then they also can wind around the torus. So there's a second quantum number, and we have this lattice appears in a very natural way. And it has this natural inner product of signature D, D, and that's how we see the t-duality group. So what about other representations of this group? So there's just the fact that there's also a spinner representation. What is the spinner representation of that group? Well, it's very simple. It's actually just the standard construction of spinner representations. You have to pick, basically make a fermionic Fock space on a half-dimensional space, but here it's very canonical. We can actually do it over the integers. If you just take the, say, the fermionic Fock space or the wedge product exterior algebra on this lattice L, that is a natural representation for this group ODD, of course, of dimension 2 to the D. Well, this has also another interpretation. It has an interpretation as being the total cohomology of the torus. I think I'll actually have to take the dual lattice here. I think I want to take the dual lattice. It just doesn't really matter, of course, but let's do it like this. Then we have a canonical identification of this exterior algebra with the total cohomology of the manifold. And furthermore, if we go to the subgroup of SODDZ, then of course this H star decomposes in the even plus the odd cohomologies, which are, say, the positive and negative chirality spinners. So this is plus spinner and a minus spinner. Sorry?
What do you mean by
that? Oh, good point. So let's just take the connected component of. Is that what you? Sorry? Yes. Yeah. I think that's you know, yeah, just the thing that intersects SODDR, I think it's good enough. So we have the odd and the even cohomology appearing here, and they have an interpretation, so which will be important in, I guess, also in many of the other things that we've been discussing here at this meeting, is that even and odd cohomology will be identified with the K0 and K1 of the torus. So this is obvious link. Is the studying vector bundles on this. But just this fact that these spinner representations are kind of appearing very naturally, or at least have a very natural geometric interpretation. So we can think of, and this is where the story of B-brain centers. I'm not going to tell you very much about B-brains at this point, but just say that there are extra states associated with cycles, say C inside R space X, which in our case is a torus. And so there is a this say M theory or non-perturbative string theory. Well, the d-dimensional torus will have a lattice, so I already said in the beginning. One of the things that we want to kind of associate to any string compactification is a lattice of charges. And these letters will have a decomposition now in terms of this Narayan letters. So this is the thing coming from the conformal field theory, plus other pieces. And there will be also a piece which I call Gamma D, which are is the D-brain letters. And there might be actually more pieces here. So I'm not giving here the general answer, but I will go in a moment to an example where the D-brain letters is really everything there is, where Gamma D is, well, let me write it like, for the moment like this, is even or odd cohomology of the torus. So what we are doing, instead of just looking at things which carry momentum, which is the things that point particles do, and things which carry winding number, which is what strings do, we also introduce objects, say, which are of a general dimension and are associated with cycles into our torus.
Do you want cohomology or
Well, here for the torus, I think it all doesn't really matter. So I can have various, well, I can be more, well, okay, so this will be just say K naught of K1 of the torus. I'm only doing the torus here. So let's go to a very explicit example, which is the thing I want to focus on for the rest of my lecture, which is the case of the four torus. So we already saw that we have, let's take this group. This was the T-duality group, and we had this Narayan letters gamma 4-4 naturally associated to it. So this was L plus L star. And remember the Dinkin diagram of this group and the famous triality. Then we can think of this eight-dimensional representation as being the vector representation, say, associated to this duality group. Well, it depends on whether we do the bosonic string or the superstring. Since I want to do the superstring, we do SO.
So, the T-duality on one circle we consider part of the duality?
For the type 2 string, you mean?
Oh, I see.
Well, I want to stick with... no, it would not. I mean... Sorry.
I want to switch
from 2A to 2B. I just want to have one particular conformal field theory. I mean, that's by definition what I think is a T-duality. Yeah, because it would map one conformal field theory to another conformal field theory, I think.
But then, in the M theory list, you're not allowed to. If you never see T-duality on one circle.
No, there I do see it, I think.
No, two circles.
Sorry?
Two circles. So there's this extra thing, which is not a symmetry, but it's a T-duality, which is really a duality because it's at least a different description, which is T-duality on the set. And it's not to be considered part of the duality group without
that. Well, the point is that everything I was saying is somehow kind of not respected by that symmetry. So, yeah, it's I guess, yeah, it's a little confusing. It's somehow in between a U and a T-duality, but it's, yeah.
The question is, does every duality have to be a symmetry? Or can it be an identification? It's a linguistic question, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not a linguistic question.
T-duality in one circle is an identification between two different theories.
Okay, that's a duality between two different descriptions.
Okay.
Actually,
these two
not part of the symmetry group.
Right. You could make a moduli space of all type 2 theories which would have two components. And then that would have a bigger symmetry group, but which would contain the V2 that extends.
Normally, if you made a coverage,
you can talk about
2B
as a particular limit of M3, and then it gets to M1.
Well, what that's is that the boundary of M theory has more than one component.
Okay, David is a confused.
Anyhow, it's very important for me that this is SO at this point, because now there are two other eight-dimensional representations, which I mentioned, which are the spinner and the conjugate spinner. So there's a, say, again, the spinner representation, which in my notation would be the even. So we identify this with the even cohomology of the torus, or with K nuts. And there's gamma 4 for conjugates, which is the odd exterior power, or the odd cohomology, or K1 of the space. In this particular case, the full, say, n theory lattice gamma is given by gamma 4 4 vector plus gamma 4 4 spinner. So these are the strings, and these are the D-brains. And now we are, the claim is that the full symmetry of string theory acts naturally on that lattice, and so we'll interchange in particular the D-brains with the strings. So the full symmetry, or the u-duality, in this case, is supposed to be, well, no, again, I have to be careful whether it's S or, I think here it's just SO by Z. This group has a natural 16-dimensional representation, which is, say, a chiral spinner. Yes, yes. Right, I'm doing the 2A theory. If I had done the 2B theory instead of the representation S, I would have added this representation C.
So Greg's question becomes relevant again, because...
Precisely. Yeah, there is a natural symmetry, or there is a transformation. The element of O, which is not sitting in SO, will map this to this spinner, to the conjugate spinner. So it will do precisely what he... So this is a very obvious candidate. Well, we all know what the transformation is and how it would act. But it doesn't act on this lattice. It transforms this lattice on... No. Yes, that's an important point. So... If you take a 16-dimensional representation of this group, well, of SO55, if you decompose it under SO44, you get typically two spinner representations, and up to triality, you can identify them with these two eight-dimensional representations. So this contains the T-duality group SO44Z, which again contains this geometric symmetry, which is only SO4Z. So one of our aims is to kind of understand, to some extent, the appearance of this group, or at least what the implications are of that group, and to which extent these implications can be verified. So as I said, what we now have to do is, well, we discussed in great extent this part of the state, say, which were labeled by vectors which were purely composed of string winding modes and momenta, but now we have to study the states which are given by this sector, which are the D-brains. So for us now, a D-brain carries a charge, V, which, say, sits inside this charge lattice gamma 4-4-S, which we can identify with, say, that's just the even cohomology, or the corresponding K-theory. And we think of this as being as a, so this is a Poincaré dual to a certain cycle, C inside, an even dimensional cycle, inside our four torus. So what we want to do is to somehow quantize the D-brain. So to this every charge vector V, we want to construct this vector space, H of V. Now, we are only going to do this in a certain approximation, Because what we're not, we don't really want to compute this full Hilbert space, but what we want to compute is the BPS, which are sitting inside this full Hilbert space. And in order to compute this number of BPS states, we're kind of using a semi-classical approximation of quantization, where we replace, well, what we do is first we will obtain from our data a manifold, and then we will do quantum mechanics on that manifold. So this looks rather ad hoc, and I'm not going to, I think others might kind of motivate more why this is the right way to proceed. But let me just continue, and treating it as a cookbook recipe. So semi-classically, so that means in the limit where alpha prime goes to zero, you're close to the conformal field theory point. The first step is to take this vector V and associate to it a space N of V, which I will call the moduli space, but it's of course a different moduli space. It's the moduli space, say, of the D-brain, not the moduli space of the string theory where we are computing things. So roughly our picture is we have our manifold X, so in this case the torus, and inside this X is sitting some cycle C, and we have the data that specify our manifold X, but now we have the data that specify how the cycle C sits inside the space X. And what we then will do is, so that's step one. Step two is then we will quantize this moduli space, which means that we do supersymmetric quantum mechanics on the space NV. That means we get a Hilbert space, which would be just the ring of differential forms on NV. And again, the Hamiltonian would be just the Laplacian. And then out of that, we will compute something very simple, because we compute the HBPS of V, and we just declare it to be the cohomology, or if you wish, the harmonic forms on this moduli space, NV.
So this
right. Well, I must say I'm not completely sure what the general recipe is, but of course I will, in my particular case, I will go to a situation where it's a smooth manifold and this will not come up. But in general, this we would like to, yeah, I think L2 is a good candidate. Sorry? You would do that, precisely, yes. Yes, 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 I agree. So these are kind of ground states in the quantum mechanics. So things which are say harmonic wave functions, and they would correspond to the special BPS states in the spacetime. So we're only computing a few states, because this will typically be a finite number, a few states associated to the D-brain. There will be many, many more. As we've shown from the string theory also, there's a huge Fock space associated to any state. But we will only be comparing BPS states. So this will be the cookbook recipe, and we're going to apply it. And but we want to, what will be our aim? Well, the aim will be to compare this to a computation. So here we had, what do we get? We get a V in, say, we get some HBPS Hilbert space using this recipe. But we can compare it to a similar computation where we take, say, this is really a conformal field theory state, and compute HBPS over there. And we want to see that these formulas are, perhaps I should, well, yes. What you want to see is that these formulas here are actually identical, which is will imply for us that at least on the level of BPS states, there will be a symmetry exchanging these two lattices. And if you have a group element exchanging these two lattices, actually, together with the group O44Z, that will generate SO55C. So it will show us there's a symmetry interchanging strings with D-brains, which is the first kind of hint of a bigger symmetry which goes beyond just the conformal field theory structure. So let me just end by telling you how to compute the DPS states for the string theory. So this is a rather standard computation. So the point is that we are in the type 2A superstring. So I slightly have to modify what I was telling you in the beginning, which was just the bosonic string. So the superstring, say, we compactify, well, we can actually compactify it quite generally on the torus times some flat piece. Then the Hilbert space of the superstring will be, again, well, it will be, what will it be? It will be L2 functions on T times T star, well, times of tensor, of course, the L2 functions on the non-compact piece. Well, what am I doing here? Well, let me forget. Just keep things which have zero momentum in this remaining space-time. Tensor with these Fock spaces, F plus and F minus. The point is that now, for the superstring, the definition of the Fock space is slightly different, because it's again, of course, it has this the same formal structure. But now, it's not, in our case, in the previous case, in the bosonic case, we just had, say, a vector space appearing here, a bosonic vector space. But for the superstring, there's something which is a graded vector space. And actually, for the superstring, it turns out to be the graded vector space R88. So this is a 16-dimensional vector space with 8 bosonic and 8 fermionic components. So this is a standard result about... So this has, of course, again, sorry, a decomposition in graded pieces. So this is the structure of the Hilbert space, say, the perturbative Hilbert space of the superstring compactified on the torus. And now we can go to BPS states. No, this is independent of the, of actually, the, these are kind of the oscillators, so they don't see the compactification at all. Just means that there are 8 transversal bosonic directions and 8 transversal fermionic directions. So BPS states satisfy the condition that, say, well, we remember we had L naught bar. It was given by, in my formula, a momentum contribution plus, say, an oscillation contribution coming from the Fock space, and BPS states satisfy the condition that n minus equals to 0. Using that fact, you can easily compute what the degeneracies are. So from this, you find the following thing, that the Hilbert space of BPS states. Well, first of all, as promised, it's graded by a lattice, which in this case is the Norine lattice. This is lattice gamma d, d, where the momentum vector p takes value. And then we just get this component f of 1 half p squared, where this is just the quadratic form on this lattice. And f of 1 half p squared is just this piece over here. So we find, just say that n plus, we got this by solving the constraints. Well, let's see, now I did something wrong. Okay, I want to probably want to do this. I think I want to change this and put n plus x to 0. Sorry. So the right movers which are excited in this formula. So we have a very simple formula here. So the dimensions, dimension formula is d of p. So just the dimension of this graded piece, which is easy to compute. And also that it's very simple in this case to find the mass formula, because the mass formula just comes from the usual dimension formulas in the conformal field theory. We find that the mass of the state of momentum p is just the absolute value of the component p plus. So these are standard results in for perturbative, or so these are our perturbative VPS states. It's a completely standard computation in conformal field theory. And what I want to do tomorrow is to compare this computation with the computation I can do on this side, where we use semi-classical quantization of these cycles of D-brains in order to see that the same result appears. And then I will also discuss some attempts to give a formulation of the theory that really treats all of these objects symmetrically, and where this group O5Z is appearing in a natural way as the symmetry of the whole system. I mean, here I'm again kind of working my way up. I'm just using conformal field theory and supplementing it with extra objects, trying to find a bigger symmetry. But of course, ideally, you would like to give an a priori definition of the object and just see that there is this big symmetry over there, and only if you go to a certain corner of our description that it will decompose in this particular way and we get the conformal field theory result back. But for the moment I will just outlining these results. That was a very simple formula for the degeneracies. The dimensions of the BPS states on the conformal field theory side of the story, and that we have to see how these results come out by quantizing the D-brains tomorrow. Okay, I'll stop here.
What is the modern
state of these things? So, it's something I will discuss in more detail tomorrow, but it will be, that should be the space of coherent sheaves of a particular kind of Turing classes on this torus. Well, one point I think, and which makes a discussion about this general line how I started so difficult, is that, I mean, the story is constantly very complicated. Basically, whenever you add an extra dimension, there's often a new object appearing, and somehow the rules become more complicated. But, so, I think at this point, I'm personally at least completely unable to give a coherent presentation for string theory compactification on any manifold. It's somehow really kind of we work by example. And I think there's a really fundamental reason for this. And the fundamental reason is that there are all these extended objects in string theory. So it's whenever the compactification manifold, the dimension of the compactification manifold becomes higher, somehow the stories become more complicated because there are new objects that can appear in the theory. And for instance, I'm stopping at here on the four torus, and not stopping on the four, and not picking the four torus by accident. Because if I would have picked the five torus, for instance, part of the story, say, just kind of the abstract description of the symmetry group, which would be E6 in that case, and the way it which acts on these lattices, it's quite easy to do. But then we'll actually see there's another object, the so-called five ray, NS five ray, which will appear there, which will not be easy to describe. So I don't, for instance, have a... Nobody, I think, at this point has any system which carries, for instance, this E6 symmetry in a very natural way. And if you go to a 6 torus or a 7 torus, the story only becomes more and more complicated. Well, if I would have taken a manifold which is, say, smaller dimension, somehow the story wouldn't be as rich. This is somehow the example which is, I think, right on the frontier, in the sense it carries all the non-trivial aspects, but it's very difficult to push it any further. So somehow we work by example, which is, it's just, I think, due to the fact that we don't really know what string theory is, so we have to somehow, it's I think it's a little bit comparable to if you have like the classifications of simple Lie algebras, but if they're small rank, then they're all kind of accidental identifications, and it's actually quite literally what's happening here, that if the space dimension is small, then somehow the system might be kind of dual to something which is somehow simpler. And that's why we have, for these low dimensional cases, have explicit formulas and not for the general case.
In anticipation of tomorrow, you made a perturbative computation.
Yes,
here.
Yes.
I presume you're looking for the duality, which is going to change this perturbative theory to a non-perturbative theory. And you're making a non, and the semi-classical approximation is sort of a non-perturbative computation.
Yes.
Now,
but then doing it semi-classical, yes.
Yeah, but presumably, quote, that's protected by supersymmetry.
Yes.
It's more or less.
It's like an Euler number or something. Yes,
something.
Precisely.
So presumably you can.
Yes.
Bring it down to another semi, another perturbative computation.
Yes, I mean that's certainly. I mean one way to say, another way to say it is just this is will be a computation which only can be seen to be valid in a particular corner of the moduli space, and so the symmetry group that I'm looking for. I mean I'm looking for a certain symmetry group, and an important thing to realize is that if I say for instance there's a symmetry which interchanges states, it's always also acting on the moduli of the theory, right? So the important thing is we always have this picture of a bundle of vector spaces. So we don't think of a symmetry as acting on one component of the vector space because it will also act on the base. So for instance, the kind of symmetry I'm looking for is precisely a symmetry which will map you away from the point where you actually were sitting, which was close to the conformal field theory description.
Yeah.
So if I what I'm doing actually, I will be comparing two computations which are close to this particular point. So it's somehow, I mean, really have to use this fact that I'm essentially computing something topological to see that I have the symmetry, because I have then to take that computation and then continue it all the way down to this point where I don't have any control, but the fact that I know it's some kind of an index tells me that this is valid computation. But it's indeed an important ingredient that this is kind of protected by all kind of reasons, and then we can compute in one little corner and believe that this is the result all over the moduli space.
I didn't understand some of what you said, but I'll discuss it with you.
Okay, that's a copy.